It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 453 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so much for listening. This week, it's another great crowdfunding doubleheader. First up is Niyasha Mugawazi from Kugali Media. She talks about Nani Volume 2, which is now available on Kickstarter for your support. Here's how it's described. It's an epic fantasy comic about two sisters who find themselves transported to a magical world inspired by African myths and legend. The two main characters are sisters Mina and Lamin. We explore other characters that have been created by Zeke Nelson and Jamonis Lamy as well. I'm probably butchering all those names, by the way. You can go to Kickstarter and support this wonderful thing, which they have already met their goal, but there are wonderful stretch goals now in place. So once you listen to this episode, I encourage you highly to go out and support Nani Volume 2. You can get Volume 1 there as well. Then everything concludes with my fun conversation with the folks from Black Tiger Legacy of Fury. That's writer John Hervey and artist Rod Looper. This book comes from Beyond Time Comics, and you can get it through Indiegogo. Here's how this book is described. Brother battles sister with the fate of their city and family legacy at stake in 172 pages of comic book glory. We talk about the Black Tiger and that legacy, as well as how important that is to the main characters in the series, and what stories we can expect from these creators in the future. There's a lot to get to in episode 453, so let's get on with the show.
With their lives in danger, two sisters are transported to the dangerous and magical world of Sama. Inspired by African myths and legends, Sama is a world rife with magic and beauty. Despite being beautiful and breathtaking, this world is also full of danger and uncertainty. Blood magic, moon rituals, and strange creatures known as the Fallen, all present in this new and uncharted world. So with no route back, the sisters are left with no choice but to adapt to this new world or perish.
It's great to be talking with Niyasha Mugawazi from, I gotta make sure I get this right, Kugali Media. And you have a great book that's on Kickstarter right now, Niyasha. And let me make sure I get the name right. I don't want to miss it. It's Nani, and it's called A Fantasy Graphic Novel Inspired by African Mythology. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Wade. Thank you. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. I'm so interested in mythologies and things that I haven't heard before. And as I was talking with you about before we started to record, I talked with the folks from Is Nani the Werespider a bit too. And I guess they have some African mythology involved too, but it sounds like it's a little different from yours. So I'm happy to keep learning and finding out new stuff. Why don't you talk about first thing, let's dive into what the graphic novel is about. Why don't you explain what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nani is a story about two sisters who find themselves in a very precarious situation where they end up being transported to a fantasy world in which all the magic and mythology from their West African culture is real and living. And throughout this process, they have to navigate not only finding a way to get home safely, but also helping the friends they make in this world as well, known as Sama, who are in the midst of a battle, an existential battle, really, between good, what seems to be good, and what seems to be evil.
Mm-hmm. See, I love learning about stuff that I don't know much about. And the fact that this has to do with African mythology just grabbed me. I saw it on Twitter. I saw your things going on, and I said, gosh, I'd like to find out more about that. And so the important thing we got to get to right away, of course, is the Kickstarter. You've got a Kickstarter going on, and it's going to conclude on Thursday, October 1st at 11:01 a.m. Eastern Time. And that's, of course, a different time where you are. But the important thing is there's not a lot of time left to jump on board. So it's called, I want to make sure I get the name right. It's called Nani, A Fantasy Graphic Novel Inspired by African Mythology. And I'm just fascinated by it. I got a chance to read Volume 1, which I appreciated. So why don't we talk a little bit about, because you're the editor of this book, right?
I am, yes.
So that's great. What's your role in Kugali?
So my role in Kugali in general is a senior editor. I've been with Kugali for about 3 years now, and so I've had the pleasure of watching them grow and also like helping them build and really figure out what role they have to play in the future of comic books as well. So my role, I work with writers when they are in the developmental phase of their stories, so helping them flesh out characters and plots and narratives. And I also edit comic books that are ready for publication as well.
Cool. I'm going to read the description on the Kickstarter page. It says, Kugali showcases the best African stories by Africans using comics, art, and animation. These are stories that respect the history of Africa, embrace the present, and imagine a future, which I think is really cool. That's something I, as I was telling you before we started to record, I don't know much about this, and I need to know more. So, like I said, when I came across your stuff, I was just so fascinated by it. Now, the big thing, we'll talk a little bit about the Kickstarter before we get back into the book. As it points out on the webpage, the Kickstarter project, you got funded in 10 hours. Boy, congratulations on that.
Thank you, Wayne. Yeah, it was very humbling. And I think we're all incredibly grateful for the support we received from our pre-existing fans, as well as from new fans who've just heard about Kugali through this Kickstarter. It's also really incredible and inspiring for, I think, a lot of other creatives out there who are based in Africa or who are immersed in African culture as well, to know that people want to read this content and that they should keep creating it.
Because, mm-hmm. A good story is a good story.
Exactly.
And so for me, I've read Thor for decades now. And as I've often said to people, I don't think Marvel has many more ideas for him. But there are so many mythologies in the world that we haven't even really explored very well. And so to me, to see this is just a great thing. And I have to say, the goal in American dollars was $12,747, which I'm sure is a little different in the original money system. But as we're talking, it's over in our money, $43,000 you've gotten. So you're like, what, 3-4 times what you were originally asking? You're almost to 1,000 backers, and hopefully by the time this posts, you'll have passed that and good things. So this is just a great thing. I think this is such a great thing to see. I'm so happy. I'm also extremely happy. Anybody listens to this podcast know I'm big on female leads, because I think male leads, we have explored that for decades and decades. And, female leads, and particularly this one, which has two female leads, I'm fascinated by, because, the female personalities in comics tend to be Lois Lane, as I like to tell people. Mm. And so for these two characters who are not Lois Lane, I really got a huge kick out of meeting them and getting to know them and studying them. And there's another character in the book. Well, let's, the name of the character, one is Mina, and the other one, if I pronounce it wrong, let me know. It's Lamine?
Lamine, yeah.
Lamine, okay. And then we have Lay, looks like L-A-Y-E. That's another character, female character that's in it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think often female characters are very much Lois Lane, very much like smart, intelligent, outgoing, but also ultimately a damsel in distress. And I had a very similar reaction to you when I was brought on as an editor and saw the first version of Nani. And I saw this young girl who can't be much younger or older than me, who on the one hand is dealing with PTSD, but on the other hand is really able to stand up for herself and the people who she loves consistently. And that was really touching.
Mm-hmm. See, now, of course, I asked you before, I give you a chance to get ready for it. Why is it called Nani?
So Nani actually comes from the Hausa word Tunani, which means self-reflection and growth through said self-reflection as well. And so it's a shortened version of that word. Hausa is a language spoken in West Africa and in countries including Nigeria. And the word kind of relates a lot to the challenges Mina, the older of the two sisters, faces, and the battle that exists within her, as well as a few of the other characters as well in their own way too.
Yeah, which is great, because, you know, I was puzzled because I looked over the names of the characters and I didn't see that word anywhere. So I'm always like to I'm always wanting to know how things got the way they are. So I have to ask those kinds of things just so I know. So it's very cool. So it's a great book. Now, as I was looking at the video on the Kickstarter, I got to see Zeke Nelson, the writer and creator. And then we get to there's Jasonis Lamy, the illustrator. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. You are there as the editor, which is great to see. And then the colorist is there, Christina Alvarez. And I love the look. Of course, now that I mentioned people, I got to mention Bill Masuku. I hope I'm getting that right. Then once you start naming people, you got to get them all, or else I'll be in big trouble. But it happens with every book. So it's volume one has already come out, and like I said, I got a chance to read it, and it's just a fascinating story. You know, they're in this different world. It's called, I think, a Sama. Yes, and the great thing about it, when they go there, in my mind, all bets are off. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, it's the way that's described here, it's a magical world inspired by West African myths and legends. It's been lovingly designed to showcase the beauty of African art and storytelling, which is great. And then if you look on the page, there's several drawings of the characters that we get to see. And there's stuff I've never seen before, which, you know, for me, whenever I see something I haven't seen before, I'm fascinated, because I've read comics a long time. And to see something new is just always a treat. So this book is just one of those great treats. And when I got to read the first volume, it was really kind of an interesting thing for me to see the two different sisters and how different they are, and to see how they get along and how they work together. One of them, of course, is the go-getter, and the other one is not quite a go-getter.
Yeah.
And so the two of them have to kind of discuss these things and work things out, which is fun. So talk to me about the history of Nani. I mean, when did the first volume come out?
Oof, the first volume came out, wow, I think it must have been towards the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, although I'd have to look up the exact date. But yeah, it's the first kind of original Kigali's own comic book that we've published. So written within Kigali and illustrated within Kigali, and published within Kigali. And so it's very dear to all of us. And again, that's one of the reasons why we've been so touched by all the support we've received for the Kickstarter as well. And it was also, it was incredible to see the way it came out exactly how we'd hoped, and actually better for a first original too, and in general. And so it's been a project that has received a lot of heart, a lot of love, and a lot of work from all of us.
Mm-hmm. Now, talk a little bit about, like, Mina. When I look on the Kickstarter project, it talks about that she's in her late teens and was born and raised in Nigeria. Is that where the quote-unquote real parts take place? Are they in Nigeria?
Yes, all the real parts in Nigeria. So Mina is kind of, your archetypal Nigerian teenager who you would meet with a little extra punch and a little extra kick, as you will discover throughout the story as well. But her and her sister are essentially just leading relatively ordinary teenage lives. Mina herself just kind of happens across an elderly man who's being mugged by two men, and she tries to intervene and ends up being severely injured. And so when the story begins, she is struggling with PTSD, but at the same time trying to lead a normal life. And so in the early scenes, you see, you know, Mina and Lamin in a martial arts class, and Lamin convincing Mina to go on a ride with her boyfriend and his friend, and sort of lie to their parents about where they are. And I think it'll bring back a lot of nostalgia for a lot of young people as well, to kind of have that memory of, like, you know, there's always the friend who has to be convinced to sneak out.
I probably mispronounced her name. It's Mina. I probably said Mina, but I'm glad you let me know what the correct pronunciation is for these things. That's an interesting part of the story. And you're right. It's that initially when they're together, they assume it's going to be a social gathering, and it's,
there's other things going on that start the story moving in the direction that it goes. And it's, you know, it's very dramatic, the thing I really like about it. You know, in comics, there's a lot of punching and kicking usually going on. And if somebody can tell a more dramatic story in which there's like danger involved, but it's not so much violence as it is, you know, a threat of violence. And it's one of the things I like about the story at the beginning is that we get to see some of these things, and the threat, it takes a little while before things start to move towards a more physical nature. But the threat at the beginning was what grabbed me. I really got I was like, wow, you know, if I was in this kind of situation, how would I respond? And it's really interesting to see the two of them. And of course, it's a great situation to tell the difference between the two sisters, which I liked. Mm. And then when they get into Sama, as that happens, there's a whole bunch of things, of course, you know, one of the sisters is anxious to go forward and let's discover what's going on here. And the other one's going, let's go home.
Yeah. So
I got a kick out of that because, you know, in a way that's good because they're going to represent the readers. You know, some of the readers are probably out there going like, well, why don't they just go home? You know, why are they going forward? And the discussion that they have is great because it outlines why they're moving forward and what they're trying to accomplish. So I like that about there. And whenever there's something going on, they can talk amongst themselves and explain kind of to the reader what's happening and why. And I like that because, you know, most comics tend to be about one character. You know, Batman tends to be Batman, and he's got to have Commissioner Gordon to talk to and Robin to talk to and stuff. But they're kind of secondary characters. To have two primary characters, I thought was a real – I haven't seen that I can remember before. So that was a real, you know, a real accomplishment, I thought, to have something like that, particularly two female characters that are dealing with these things. I really enjoyed that. I thought that was a very unusual way to go and a very positive way to move forward. So I, as far as that goes, I really wanted to say that was something that I really enjoyed.
Amazing. I'm glad. Yeah. And I think having these two lead characters as well, like you said, it makes the story more real in a way because there will always be a voice of reason in that. I think I find Landman's voice quite grounding throughout the comic book. I am definitely one of those readers who's like, hold on, take a second. Let's think about this before we get too involved in this war that's been brewing since before dawn, before the dawn of time. And so, yeah, I really enjoy having Landman's character in there as well for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things we've talked about and something I want to talk a little bit more about is the African mythology. Can you talk a little bit? I know we don't want to spoil too much of the story, but can you talk a little bit about what kinds of things we see that is based in African mythology? What kind of characters and situations we come across?
Yeah, definitely. So I guess the one of the components would be the mythical creatures who actually exist within the story, a lot of whom you will get to see more in Narnia Volume 2 than you've seen in Volume 1. So that's something to look forward to. In addition to that, the magic system is very deeply rooted in West African culture as well. So you have this idea of a divine rhythm, this energy that pulsates throughout every living organism, exists within us as well as without us. And in order to master this magic or to harness this magic and use it for yourself, you have to be able to engage with this rhythm and dance with this rhythm. And it requires a lot of power, a lot of practice, but it is something that we can all access.
It's interesting. Now, one of the things that the Kickstarter talks about is the fact that there are tribes of these various creatures and beings, and they're divided, interestingly, into two groups. It says here, the chosen who serve as the ruling class and the fallen who are thought of as lesser beings. I don't know why it is in societies we always have to do that. We have to kind of create, you know, plateaus into which people go. And there's always seems to be, I mean, nobody creates a social status or a system that they don't put themselves on top. And so I'm sure the chosen, you know, are probably the ones who set this whole thing up. And the fallen are the people who weren't involved in all that process. Am I right on that, or is that way off?
So I am going to leave that as a question for you to be able to figure out when you read Volume 2, because I don't want to spoil it for you or the audience.
Okay.
But one thing that I will say is that I think whenever we create one of these systems, whether it's social, whether it's within a group circle, history has a tendency of running away with us a little bit. And so I think, yeah, as you go on, you figure out the very two different narratives that the Chosen and the Fallen have about what exactly happened, to put them in the situations they are in. And sort of slowly uncovering and unraveling what really happened and why these issues are manifesting at the time they are manifesting, I think gives us a lot to reflect on, within our own societies as well, and with the stories we tell ourselves about how we got where we are, and why other people aren't where they are, where we are as well. I think Nani has a lot of very strong parallels with the world in which we exist in. Another one of those parallels would be, you know, the story of Minna and Lamin kind of essentially going home in a sense and re-engaging with like a more traditional, less mixed with Western culture version of their own heritage, which I think is something that a lot of young people of African descent are doing now, myself included, you know. And yeah, I think that's very powerful.
No, that's, I'm just sure I'm going to mispronounce this. It's Lai. How is it? How is that word pronounced? How's her name?
Laya.
Okay. See, I know I messed that up. The thing I really she as a character, according to the Kickstarter and according to the story, she's the most visually in touch with African culture and tradition, the complete opposite of the other two. She is there to provide insight into their background and stuff like that. She's the way they'd like to be. And I like that. It's nice to have somebody like that. You know, I'm so grateful it's a girl, to be honest with you. I was in stories like this, normally this kind of character would be an older male, you know, and it was so nice to see something different with that and with her being that she's kind of the advisor, but she on many levels can relate to the two of them. So I thought that was a very smart way to do that. I was really impressed when I came across that.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think also there's this component of her, like really respecting them as well and seeing them as equals, which is very important. You know, it's the two kind of sets of people, both Minna and Lamin and Laya can learn from each other. And that's really beautiful to see as well for someone who presents themselves as, or arrives in the story as a leadership figure to learn from her mentees. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we've got to talk about the bad guy. And again, if I'm pronouncing this wrong, let me know. Is it Kor?
So I think his name is Rojali, the kind of lead.
Okay. Well, there's a character on the website spelled, it's K-O-R-E, Kor. Is that who that is?
Oh, Kore. Yes, of course. Kore. Yeah.
It says here he's the leader of the Kura clan, a motley group of were-hyenas living in exile, and they are the antagonist of the story. Yes. Now, who was the person? You were just talking about who?
Rojali. Rojali is Kora's second hand, essentially.
Okay. Yeah, so who is that person? I will talk about Kore in a second, but who's the second hand person?
So you have Kore, who's the leader. Rojali is kind of almost like a lieutenant figure, who is there consistently throughout the story as well. He's also one of these, the Kore is, he is a Kura as well, so a were-hyena. He's a very interesting counterpoint to Kore, I think, as well, in a lot of ways. And I think the way in which they both deal with the issue of justice is very interesting. I find Kora actually quite an admirable figure in a way, in comparison to Rojali, because he is dignified and he is compassionate. You know, in the midst of all the evil he does, he's able to recognize, you know, for example, that children feel fear and you should try and avoid making children feel scared. He's a very intriguing character to me. And I think he's one worth looking at as more than just a villain and almost as like a thinker in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really interesting, because it says on here that the Kuras rebelled against the ruler of Sama and then were consequently exiled into a barren wasteland. And I'm sure it's sorry, I think. And no longer willing to accept the life of poverty and strife, they incite a rebellion in hopes of restoring his clan to former glory, which is kind of interesting. Cause all these things, I always like the – and it also describes in here, and this I think is a coming-of-age story, which I'm always fascinated by. I think this is – it's going to be a very different take on it, though, than any of the ones that I've read before, because you've got this very unique setting that, to me, I really am enjoying. And I want to get the Kura and the Kura clan – I'm just fascinated about that, because they are the gateway to getting into Sama for the two lead characters, if mm-hmm. I understand it correctly. Is that correct?
No, so they aren't. I think the, and again, this is one of those things that I think is best left for a question mark, as a question mark okay. for this podcast. Okay. Need to explore in volume two as well. But there's, I think, both Minna and Lamina are really genuinely confused as to how they ended up there. And so are most of the people who they interact with throughout the story. No one can really explain why it is they're here, why they arrived when they did. And so, you know, but everyone's like, okay, cool, you're here. This is what's happening. How can you contribute? Giving them the best support they can, given the circumstances. But it is largely a mystery to most of the people in the story, as it is for the audience as well.
So that'll unfold as the books continue.
Yes.
Okay, so that's something to pay attention to as I go forward. Yeah, from what I saw, they start things to move, and they have something to do with how this all starts to move forward. But that's more than that. We shouldn't talk about, because we don't want to spoil good stuff, but it's a really interesting tale, and I love the we should talk a little bit about the artwork too. I really enjoy the artwork. I mentioned the artist, and I thought that that's his Jasana Slami. Is the artwork that he's using, is that a uniquely West African style? What's his style as far as, like, what does he bring to this book?
So Jasonis is a Zimbabwean-born artist as well. And he I think, is more experienced in, like, anime-style artwork and has been really recentering his art style within the African context through his work with Kigali. And so that's been a bit of a journey for him as well. I'm just very much in love with the artwork as well. So he illustrates it. He designs all the characters and all the kind of landscape and like all the faces we see, all the expressions are all just Jasonis kind of capturing the story in a way that brings it to life.
Mm-hmm. Now, normally I would ask an author this, and maybe you can answer too, but as far as the art and as far as the story goes, are the characters original? Are they based on something? I mean, who they are and how they look. How did the characters come about? Is it a product of their imagination? Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. So to my understanding, both the characters and their personalities as well as their appearance are both original. Knowing Zeki as a writer, a lot of his stuff is very original, and it's, you know, despite having known him for 3 years, I'm still always very surprised when he comes up with an idea. He has a very, very creative mind. And similarly with Jasonis, with the illustration process as well, he is bringing Zeki's image to life to an extent, and so there's a collaboration there in terms of the appearances.
Because when I interviewed David Peterson from a book called Mouse Guard, I asked him, because it seemed to be little knights, the mice were little knights, and I thought it was based on the Knights of the Round Table. But I asked him who the characters based on, and he said they were based on his friends, because he knew his friends, and he knew how they would act, and it was easy to take the characters when he understood their personality so well. But these are all basically products of their imagination. They're not based on anybody in the real world.
They're, yeah, I, the, more or less products of their imagination. I'd imagine that there are people who, you know, there are young girls, maybe cousins, friends, family, who Zeke has interacted with throughout his life, who've kind of given him an understanding of like teenage girls, not as just these damsels in distress or, you know, these figures in need of guidance, but actually people worth, like following, people worth seeing as leaders and people worth seeing as innovators as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to get back to their appearance for just a second, because the clothes that the two main characters wear, are those, just because I don't come from there, I'm not familiar with the styles and stuff that the folks in that part of the world wear, are those representative of what girls in that region would wear?
In terms of the more modern clothes they wear?
Yeah.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. I think that would, yes, definitely. I can imagine a lot of my friends from Nigeria wearing these outfits as well. And I think especially in places in the cities, for example, this is like pretty commonplace.
Because, see, again, I'm learning as I get to see this, and I appreciate being able to ask questions, because when I read stuff, I'm always bothered by questions I'd like to get the answers to. So I get to ask you some of this stuff and find out, because they do wear a lot of, well, sandals seems to be the fare that they wear a lot. And the clothing tends to, you're right, it has a more of an African feel that say somebody here in the States might wear. But that's good for us to be exposed to those kind of things and to see those kinds of things. You never know. It might inspire some folks over here to give those a try and wear those.
Their style. Sorry, clarifying question. I think I may have got confused. Do you mean the clothing they're wearing on the Kickstarter or within Volume 1 of the story?
Well, Volume 2. The clothes that they're wearing, they're sitting on a tree limb. And yes. Those clothes are, that's the one I'm particularly, because I think those are the ones people will see first. Are those, are those the Nigerian type clothes, or have they moved into this is clothes that they would wear in Sama?
So these are definitely the clothes that they would wear in Sama. These are more, so the clothes you see them wearing in Volume 1 is more representative of what you would find most people in Nigeria wearing, most people in Nigerian cities at least wearing, and most places in the rural parts of the country as well. The pictures that you'll see, the more Africanized clothing, those are based on a lot of research done on like pre-colonial clothing styles in West Africa, especially. So this is, you know, this is what people would have been wearing in the various kingdoms and civilizations that came before Africa was colonized. And so there, again, this kind of hearkening back to tradition, culture, in a more African reflected sense.
Mm-hmm. And the colors are more representative of that part of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I like that. See, again, it's an education for me. I'm getting to see these things and learn about them. So it's really, really cool stuff. And I just, the whole story to me, I mean, I read Volume 1 and I'm dying to read Volume 2. I can't wait for the come out, which leads to a question. According to, I did back the Kickstarter, which I enjoyed. I because I have a stack of books I'm trying to read that are as tall as I am, I tend to go for digital stuff. So I went for the thing that's called Digital Warrior. It gives you digital copies of both Volume 1 and Volume 2. And it also gets you recognized in the book, which I always like to do. But, there are other levels that you can sign up for, which are really great. You can be a citizen of Sama, which you get your name in there. You get to do – there's other ones, a sister of Sama. I liked all these. I love the divisions of the levels. They're great fun. You get a physical paperback. You get swag. You get to be I'm sure I'm butchering this – Miyake Elder.
Yes. No, that's perfect.
Okay, I'm sure I'm going to butcher some of them because I'm just not familiar with it. But then you get the Master of Divine Rhythm, a retailer bundle you can get. There's all kinds of wonderful things. One called a Northern Guardian, which is kind of fun. You get a signed hardcover edition, all these good things. When are the books going to become available as far as – I'm sure you know, the great thing about this Kickstarter and as opposed to other ones, I've seen some of them where they'll say, well, after we get the money, we'll start working it. But obviously, you guys – have been working on this for some time. When are the hardcovers and things like the digital will obviously be out ahead of that because you got to go through the printing process. But when will like the hardcovers and the paperbacks and stuff be available?
So as you said, we have been working on this for a very, very long time. And the illustrations have been ongoing even before we launched the Kickstarter. So we're trying to get this to a place where we can have our backers, kind of rewards and thanks fulfilled as soon as possible. I am hesitant to tell you when the shipping date will be, with regards to COVID specifically, and because that is not part of the process that I'm personally involved with. But it will be very, very soon.
It would be ideal to get these out before Christmas.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what we're leaning towards as well.
That'd be great. If you can't, you know, reality gets in the way sometimes, but it would be great. Because this, as I said, this Kickstarter ends on Thursday, October 1st, 11:01 a.m. Eastern time here in the States. Now, this is volume two. Is this the concluding volume? How many volumes are in the Nani series?
I can't tell you how many volumes up because we're yet to write them all, but this is not the concluding volume. I'll tell you that now. Yeah. And so I think if we set our eyes for, you know, getting this one, to all of you in January, I think we'll be working on the next one once these are all printed. I think this is a project that we're all very excited about, but this is definitely not the last one.
Okay. All right. So well, no idea how many it's going to, when they get done writing it, you'll know basically.
Yeah. For sure.
Gotcha. Well, you know, that's the way it is sometimes. I mean, in the States, a lot of people tend to say, we're going to do a 4-volume thing, and they know from the start what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other people, and this, I think, depends on the story. I mean, you want to write the story and make the story breathe. And the way to do that is to write it. Don't force it into a certain number of volumes. Let the story go where it needs to go.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think I completely agree with you because I think, you know, with Nani, we have a very clear idea of like how the story develops and all the different arcs. But I think, like you said, whenever you're writing a story, there are parts of it that, you know, will excite you a lot more than you imagined and that you'll want to run along with a bit more. And there'll be parts that you want to let go of as well. And so I think it's very difficult to be able to know like how many pages and how many volumes a story will take up without losing some of the organic nature of writing.
Well, obviously, you know, based on the success of the Kickstarter so far, and you haven't even gotten to the conclusion yet, there is a good amount of support out here for these kind of good things. And I'm just dying to see where this goes. I mean, the first volume really hooked me, and I'm dying to see volume two, and I'm going to be along for the ride as they go along. So, to keep up with these good things, as the Kugali website is literally kugali.com. It's spelled Kugali, in case somebody wants to find it. And it says, discover the best of African storytelling, which for me, I want to see something I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. Now, there's other stuff going on besides, as great as Nani is, you guys have other books and things coming out. Do you want to talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, for sure. So to give you a bit of background to Kugali, we started off as a platform to just like highlight and raise awareness on a lot of the really incredible comic books that were coming out of Africa and the diaspora. And as a result of our initial, you know, our kind of beginnings as a company, we have this amazing database and collection of comic books from other authors that you can also purchase through the Kugali website. And that is, some of them are hard copy as well as digital, and some of them are just digital. And, you know, one of my favorite authors on there is Junie Barr, who has this incredible almost steampunk aesthetic. It's very hard to describe, and he writes these very unique stories that go so perfectly well with a very unique artistic style, and I can't imagine anything else being illustrated in that style. And I also can't imagine anything else being written to go along with those illustrations. They're truly just such special comic books. And he's very interesting because I think he creates a lot of his comic books specifically to be published online, to kind of make room for a digital era. And also the fact that in a lot of parts of the world, printed work isn't as accessible. Printing can be very expensive and books can be very difficult for a lot of people to buy for that reason. And Kigali's own publications are very similar, just emphasizing accessibility. Everyone should be able to read comic books, whether they're affordable in print version or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I look at the website, there is one section for free comics. So if people want to check them out, it says Free Comics 1, Free Comics 2, and Free Comics 3. Then under the comics library, you have physical comics, digital comics, then you list them by most popular and also show artwork, which I think is great. Are these available, like if people in the States were looking for them, are they on like Comixology, or do we really have to go through your website to keep up with this good stuff?
To my understanding, we are mostly through our website. I know that we are working to partner with a distributor in the United States so that we can better serve our supporters there. But for now, you know, anything you order physically or digitally will make it to you in the States for sure.
Well, that's a good thing to know this. Now, as it says on your website, it says you're at Kigali Media and you're on Facebook, Twitter, it looks like YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn, and you can email as well. And it's Kigali Media, all one word. If people wanted to follow, do you have like social media to do, or should we focus on the company?
Let's focus on the company. I do also have social media, but they can find me just by just searching my name for sure. Okay.
Very good, very good. Because I think this is an untapped resource that for a lot of us here in the States. And I think this is something I think that for me, for example, it's exciting to see something new and different and you know, unique. And so for me, I'm excited by the possibility of going and reading stories I haven't read before and see them in different takes and different, you know, storytelling settings and things like that.
Definitely.
And different styles of art and different styles of writing and things. So I just think it's a great thing. I think what you guys are doing is just so good and something that I think a lot of people should really know about. Again, it's Kigali, Kugali. And I want to be sure. At the Kickstarter, it's Nani, a fantasy graphic novel inspired by African mythology. It's going to end on Thursday, October 1st at 11:01 a.m. Eastern Time here in the States. Now's the time to get out there and support it. Don't wait until you get too close because sometimes you forget. And you know they've already got good things, but what about stretch goals? Have you guys gotten to stretch goals for this?
Yeah, so we've set a few stretch goals. The one I'm most excited about, honestly, is the potential for us to turn Nani into an animated TV series. And so if we reach that, I would be incredibly happy. And we are also very happy with what we've achieved thus far. We're doing super, super, super well. Right now we're on, I think our third stretch goal. So we're working on producing a digital art book with like lots of behind the scenes and like work in progress content. The next stretch goal will be announced after we reach the current one. We're working on an ad hoc basis, but the Nani animated series pilot episode is listed as the final stretch goal. So it would be great if we could reach that.
Oh, that would be fun to see. Of course, it's probably too soon to talk about that, but if we went like through your website, let's say the animated editions do get made, would they be findable through the website?
I am not entirely sure. I'm not sure what platform we'd stream through. I'd imagine we'd want to partner with someone as well so we can reach as many people as possible with this work. But that will be something that we'll be thinking about when we start working on a potential pilot episode.
So stay tuned and support. Now's the time to support to make that kind of a good thing happen. Well, there's so much fun and such a different kind of story for me to read. And so, like I said, I'm learning so much about the different cultures and different people and all these things. It's really a great book and just a wonderful thing that you guys are doing. And again, it's Nani, N-A-N-I, and Volume 2. And you get to see Volume 1 when you support it. So there's all kinds of good things going on with it. And I have to tell you, Nyasha, this is great stuff. And I hope that a lot of people get the chance to go out there and look at your stuff and support. You've already got success going on, but you know, you could be a lot more successful in my opinion. And I think there's a lot of things that people would enjoy reading. So I hope that they get out there to Kickstarter and support it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Wayne. And yeah, thank you to all of your listeners as well for you know, taking the time to listen to me and you talk about this. This has been, it's always a pleasure to talk to someone who's excited about this. And we intend to bring you so many more comics as we grow as an organization. And we're also always open to collaborating with both writers and artists. We actually have a part of our website where people can submit story ideas as well as artwork to potentially work with us. So do not be a stranger in any sense. And again, thank you so much, Wayne.
Well, it's great to talk with you.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome to the podcast John Hervey and Rod Looper from Black Tiger Legacy of Fury, a graphic novel that is available right now on Indiegogo, among other things. John, how are you doing?
Doing well. How about yourself, Wayne? Appreciate doing you good. Having us on your show.
It's good to talk with you. And Rod, how about you?
I'm good. It's all good. All good.
Okay,
tonight.
Sounds great. Now, we'll dive right into this. John, why don't you tell us what Black Tiger Legacy of Fury is about?
So this is a story that was, and Rod can also tell you, a very long time in the making. We initially started production, it's been 15 years ago now. In terms of the concept and the idea, as a lover of comic books and as a lover of kung fu movies, Black Tiger, it's a generational power that has its origins in China. And you come to today and you have two second generation Asian Americans, a brother and a sister, and their father is the Black Tiger. Unknown to the daughter, but known to the brother because the power has been handed down through male lineage through the ages. And this is a story really of the first female Black Tiger, at least in a very long time, and how that comes to be, and kind of the some of the generational divide between the siblings and their father, including the cultural divide, which also enables her to develop her own identity as the Black Tiger, and then just also a philosophical divide between the two siblings and why Jin is the one that ends up being the Black Tiger over her brother.
Interesting. Now, I'll read what it says on Indiegogo. It says, brother battles sister with the fate of their city and family legacy at stake in 172 pages of comic book glory.
Yes, indeed.
That's what it says. Okay, John, why don't you get a little more, and then I'll start talking with Rod a little bit more. You said that you've been working on this for quite a long time. Where did the story idea come from? I mean, it's interesting. Diversity in comics is always interesting to me. So where did this story come from? Why did you want to explore this?
So this was a story idea. It must have been – having the idea, it must have been 18 years ago. I was with my my girlfriend, who's now wife of 15 years. We were on a vacation in we were up near, we were kind of on the coast in California, and, I had this idea of this generational story. You have this generational divide, but you have this cultural divide, but in so many ways, you know, we can all relate to this, whether it's the differences between our parents and our generation, or our generation and our kids' generation, you know, just, you know, differences. And we've seen this over the course of recent years, differences in ideals. And on top of that, I'm a huge lover of Kung Fu. So making a superpowered Kung Fu story was basically a mesh of all the different things that I love.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Now, Rod, how did you get involved with this story? Was John looking for an artist and he came across your art?
No, in fact, John contracted a friend of mine named Tiago Carvalho, and he asked him to make some concepts for Black Tiger. But at the time, I think he was about to travel to Europe, and he had to leave the project, and he indicated me for the project. And then I start to draw, make some concepts here and there, and John passed me some pages to do. And then he explained for me the whole story behind the whole universe of Black Tiger that he was building up, and I felt in love. And little by little, I start to build trust between me and him. And he gave me a lot of freedom that I can't find in another indie comics. So after many, many years and many, many pages draw, we became friends. And the relations was so good to create that he gave so much freedom for me and respect a lot of my ideas or my glances of ideas to the project. And then we are working together for more than 15 years, I think, or more, 17 years, I think.
Great. Now, did you have a background of like drawing superheroes or martial arts in the past, Rod?
I'm draw since I have 13 years old, so I always drawing. I worked here and there with comics before Black Tiger, but Black Tiger as an indie comic book is tough to rise up money to pay the pages and production, because comic book is very, you need a lot of money to produce a comic in this level. So John always paid from his own pocket. So sometimes he asked me to draw 10 pages or 5 pages or 7 pages. And between those pages, I work in another comics. So I work in Star Wars, I work in Dungeons & Dragons, I work in many indie comics. But I always come back to Black Tiger because I love to work with John mainly and the universe. And I felt that we are building something special with Black Tiger. I saw that in a horizon, in a future horizon, that he was building something cool until we arrived to Indiegogo campaign.
Right. Now, John, talk to me about the characters. You know, it's an interesting story, and it doesn't spoil much to say that, you know, the father is Black Tiger when things start out, and then let's just say he's no longer Black Tiger, and then it comes between the brother and the sister. Right. Were these characters based on people you knew? Are they products of your imagination? Where do they come from?
So a little bit of both. You know, products, definitely products of my imagination. The Black Tiger, the Pak Fong, who's Black Tiger, when the story begins, he is very archetypical. You know, he is kind of the hero's hero. He's the guy that, you know, I call him the Fist of Justice. You know, he's the guy that stands in the gap. He's the guy that is the hero. At least the hero that is, as when I was growing up reading comics, that you kind of expected and you loved and you rooted for. But he also has elements of him. You know, he's got kind of the Liu Kang elements with the supernatural kung fu, and heavy kind of Hong Kong martial arts influence. And he's kind of, I'd almost consider him the bridge. His father, who is in the story as well, came from China with his mom, and Pak was a baby, and he was actually birthed in the Pacific Ocean en route. So you call him Pacific, call him Pak. And then you have his children, Jennifer and Eric, and they don't share his ideals completely. Eric is, I won't say the antithesis, but Eric has very much been influenced by, you know, his peers and the world around him. He knows he's going to become the Black Tiger. Unlike his father, who is a cop by day and Black Tiger by night. So, you know, justice is really kind of in his DNA. The son has a very opposite view on the legal system, and his whole take is, you know, I won't say anarchistic, but he's on a completely different path. And on top of that, he's part of a triad. So playing inside the lines of the law are never kind of on his, in his cards. And his sister, on the other hand, has taken a path professionally much more like her dad. So she's an assistant DA. But she has traits in her that her and her brother share. And she has ways in which, of course, she has similarities with her dad. But she's her own woman with her own struggles as well. So it's really about, you know, taking a power, this traditional power, and it's now fully ensconced in American culture, because these two characters are more American than anything, Jen and Eric, and you know, finding their way or not, making their decisions, and the consequences that come along with them, and eventually the establishment of Jen as the Black Tiger. So you actually get the opportunity to see four different wielders of the power of Black Tiger, which was one of the reasons why Rod and I decided to provide a full story arc with the full 172 page story arc. So when you get it, you get a whole story arc, and, you know, including kind of your prize or button at the end. And it's a great jumping on point then for future stories.
See, that was one of my questions was going to be, you know, because so many comics now, well, they do individual issues and then they collect into a graphic novel. But you kind of skipped that first part and went to the graphic novel thing. Is that something that you think more comics are doing? Or why did you choose to go that route?
Honestly, the reason why Rod and I did that for this comic is the pacing. I think a lot of comics have more of, almost like, you know, the pacing of kind of like an animation. So you're always, you know, you're always getting your healthy dose of action plus, you know, your drama. This is a book that sets up the world. So it's 172 pages. So you get a lot of action, but there is a lot of foundation laying. And, you know, I didn't want people to feel like they're getting in individual issues. They're getting, hey, this is, you know, I'm getting some of the elements I like, but I'm not getting all the elements that I like. You know, as we go along in telling the story and having laid the foundation, and I think we're able to, you know, to give a lot more of the, kind of the pizzazz that people enjoy in the books. But the whole importance here, really, it's establishing this book, but it's also establishing the whole universe, because there are other characters and stories that we're producing all in the same universe.
Now, I got one more question for you, and then I'm going to get back to Rod. Where does this take place?
So this takes place in a western seaboard city called Los Santos. And Los Santos is a mixture, I envisioned it as a mixture between Los Angeles and San Francisco, which is funny because they're very dichotomous places. I kind of see the Chinatown of San Francisco, kind of some of the suburban areas around Los Angeles and kind of the grit and feel. And the grit and feel of Los Angeles. So it's a western seaboard city, but it's very much, you know, akin to a mixture of those two cities.
Okay. Now, Rod, the question I have, John was talking about the fact that these characters are development, kind of a mix of reality and imagination. when it came to portraying them, did you choose how they looked based on real people? Or, again, was this a mixture of imagination and reality? How did you do that?
Well, it's a mix of reality and imagination, because John, I prefer when the writer send me some reference, visual reference. So I always ask for John, who do you imagine this character? What Hollywood actor do you feel that could interpretate this character in the movie? So for me, it's easier to get reference if I have a direction to follow. But sometimes I create by myself for imagination, mainly the co-side characters or villains. I create all from imagination, but I prefer a few of them are based on Hollywood actors or movie actors or TV series, whatever I can learn with fake expressions to put it on the comic book.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good thing, because I it makes it unique. Yeah. Sometimes if characters are too close to real people, I get distracted.
Yeah.
I have to say, if I don't wreck it.
Yeah. Go ahead. I don't like also too many photograph based. For me, I prefer comic book artists as Sean Goddard, Mike Mignola, or Travis Kerridge. Guys that use photo reference, you can see that it's not only from imagination, but it's not exactly as a photo like Alex Ross. So I prefer this style of art, like Gene Lee, Mark Silvestre. They use reference, but not like Alex Ross or too high realistic.
Now, you talked about you guys have talked about that this took several years to take place. About how long did the page take you, Rod? I mean, did it take like a day or two? How did this work?
It depends. Generally, I try to finish a page a day. I prefer to wake up early in the morning. So I prefer to sketch the page until the lunchtime. And then I give myself a break, and then I keep working, cleaning up the page until beginning of the night, 7 p.m., 8 p.m., and then I stop. But I have some pages that I took more. For instance, the 4-page wrap cover from the Indiegogo campaign, it took me almost 2 weeks to finish, because it was a very complex and detailed cover. And I did in a comic book traditional paper format, 11 by 17 inch. So it took a lot of time. I have even a video from my YouTube channel that I can share with you later on if you want it.
Well, why don't you tell us how to get to that YouTube channel? How, if somebody wants to look at it, how do they go there?
Oh, yeah. You just look for 2D art, and you can find some of my work process video. And one of those is a cover that I did for this Indiegogo campaign.
Okay. Now, one more question, and I'm going to go back to John here.
Okay.
I talked about resemblances and how you did that. Now, the action sequences, too, are quite dramatic, and I thought you handled those real well. Did you use real-life examples for some of them, or were they basically your imagination creating these action sequences? How did you do those?
It's a funny part, because John is very he's a passion about martial arts, and sometimes he send me some reference on 3D models and say, man, you need to draw like that, you need to put the arm like that, the leg like that. Sometimes I can use this reference, but sometimes I prefer to exaggerate a little bit, so I don't follow by to stick to the reference. I use the reference just like a visual guide, and then I create mine myself. Because in comics, you need to always think not only in beautiful pictures, but in storytelling. So sometimes you need to leave your imagination flow. So sometimes you a really good kick of kung fu is not so good for comic book. It to be a little bit stiff. So sometimes it's a mix of both. I follow the John directions with the crazy reference that he gave me, and then I create a, above all of that.
Wow. So this is, I feel like I'm influenced by movies and stuff when I see these things.
Totally. I love it. Movies. I love it. Movies, American movie mainly. And I always, Matrix or Quentin Tarantino, whatever movie, I love it. And I always study the frames. I worked almost for 3 or 4 years with storyboard for TV commercials and propaganda. So I learned a lot of how to put cameras, angle cameras, and I try to translate that for comic books.
Mm-hmm. Is that tough translation sometimes?
Yeah, it's a different media because on storyboard, you have only one frame generally. On the page of a comic book, you have many frames, and you can work with the layout of the page. So sometimes I put a big figure in half of the page and a small panel. I like to play around with the distribution of the panels in the page, not just what is inside of the panel. I like to work like that.
Makes it visually interesting to look at.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. So now, John, I'm always puzzled as how things got the way they are. So Black Tiger, I'd never heard of a Black Tiger before. I've heard of Panther, but what is there a Black Tiger, and is that what this is modeled after? Or is this a creation of you? Where'd the Black Tiger come from?
Well, there is a Black Tiger Kung Fu. And there is, you know, kind of a story of how that system of Kung Fu was lost during the time of the Japanese occupation of China. And, you know, kind of the way the story goes is like Sifu, which is a master taught, had students, but then he also taught his servant. And his servant actually came to the States. And, you know, kind of the interesting thing is there are offsprings of Black Tiger Kung Fu now in the States, and people have kind of, you know, taken it back to China. You know, so it's kind of a full 360 degrees. But there is, a system or derivations, different systems that are called a Black Tiger Kung Fu. You know, there are some very famous martial artists like Wong Fei Hung, who was known by many names, including as a tiger. It's being able to interweave some very interesting historical facts, but still fictionalizing it. And I think that's what keeps the story grounded. Keeping it grounded in some of the culture. And the other thing that honestly that I did that just kind of play on it, because usually any character that has the name Black in it is Black. So I kind of like the idea of just kind of messing with that, you know, because Black Tiger isn't Black. And that's, but from a Kung Fu system, it's actually, the name is actually derived, from something that actually, existed.
So where are Black Tigers? Is it Japan? Or where do you find a Black Tiger?
In terms of the actual animal itself,
mm-hmm.
Now that's a unicorn.
Oh, really? So there isn't, no real Black Tiger?
No. So there is no real, there, of course, they're white tigers, but there is no real, Black Tiger. But that makes for just so much more, it's like it adds to the myth. Mm-hmm. And as you've seen the story, we actually use visions and dreams in there. And in the dream, you see the great Black Tiger, and you see the Big Red Dragon, and you know, it's fun because it brings another mythical, you know, kind of mystical element to the story.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating to me that because, you know, Black Panther and all these other, you know, whenever there's a, you know, people want to make Batman black for some reason, which I don't understand, but you know, I can understand that they want to provide differences. You know, Superman, some people think that he should be, you know, Stan Lee once imagined him as being sort of a blonde guy, sort of a almost a German kind of a thing. And then the opposite of that to him was a black person who was going to be Batman. Mm. And so to me, I always find that interesting. But I just see the great thing about this whole thing is you've taken what's a legend and you've added, you know, you got to fill in the blanks, basically. This was, you know, it gave you a starting point, and now you get to take the legend and build on this to give it some legs, basically. And God, I think that's really fascinating that you did that.
No, and it's been a lot of fun. You know, I know we've taken a good amount of creative license, but I think we've done some things that still, you know, that still honor where it comes from, and you know, just kind of point to. You know, I won't say so much a reconciliation, but you know, a modernization, you know, as well, you know, in current times.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because superheroes, everybody is, they're wondering, are we in a post-superhero age? I mean, as far as comic stories go. But, you know, your book, Between You and Rod, have developed a story where I hadn't been before. One of the things I want to talk with you about is the brother-sister rivalry kind mm-hmm. of thing. I don't see that in comics that much. And so when I came across this, I found that another creative aspect of this. Where did that part of the story come from? Is this, again, grounded in reality? Is this something that you were interested in? Is it because relationally, I don't see that in comic books. So I was kind of interested. You had a legend that you were building on. You're building on a relationship kind of thing that I'm not used to. So I got to go a lot of places with this book that I'm not used to going. So where did the brother-sister rivalry come from?
That was built a little bit more out of real life and just, you know, just seeing, you know, just kind of the lives of one of my wife's friends and just seeing, you know, just how much she really followed a path that her father, you know, really resonated with and really liked, but she was the daughter, you know, and it was kind of something that he kind of wished his son was more like his daughter, you know, as opposed to just being glad that his daughter is his daughter and his son is his son. And it just brought a different and the thing was with that was realizing not just the impact that it had on her relationship with her dad, but it's like a triangle. The relationship it had on the dad with the brother, because the sister then becomes a you know, you should be more like, right? And then what does that do to the relationship between the sister and the brother? So it's just kind of a triangle, you know. And I found that really interesting. And you know, sometimes it's the brokenness that's, you know, that's interesting. That and how do you, if you can, how do you reconcile that? You know, growing up, those two, you know, they didn't want to end up being rivals. Mm-hmm. You know, and that wasn't the father's intention either, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But here they are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Rod, this leads me right into your next question, which I found interesting. There's a panel on the Indiegogo page that shows the sister, and she is in danger, shall we say? And there's two other women. Apparently, they are, you know, they've captured her and doing something with her. And the thing I really was impressed by it is the way that you draw women. You know, there are certain artists who draw women like ugly men, and I'm always distressed by that. But with yours, I mean, you make the female character really sparkle to me, and I really enjoy the way that you did that. I mean, I always have to ask men who draw female characters and do them well. I mean, from an artistic standpoint, did you have to study you know, women in different poses to get it so it was realistic and looked like that? I mean, how did you handle tackling the female figures?
Oh, man, this is a tough question because even today, I don't like the women that I draw. I always think in the way that you said, it for me is a compliment. Thank you so much for saying that, because I always draw and think, man, this girl doesn't need to appear like a man. It needs to appear like a girl. So it's difficult, man. I study a lot. I do a lot of sketchbooks and studying. And I always try new ways to draw a woman because it's really hard, because mainly characters in comic books, mainly in superheroes, are men. Mm-hmm. So we are going in that direction always. Even when I draw an old guy, for instance, the guy starts to on the first sketch, probably the old guy will have muscles, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Huge muscles. And then say, no, wait a minute, it's an old guy. He don't need to have huge muscles. So with the women, is the same thing. We need to policy ourselves all the time, because it's very, very easy to make women to appear like a men's. And we have another thing, that they need to appear girls, but they are super girls. So they have muscles, but it's not exactly as men's. So it's tough, man. It's tough. I still today, I'm trying to improve myself in draw women's.
Wow. See, it's interesting when I talk to male artists who are drawing women, they always say the same thing like you do. I don't think I do it that well. But yet when I look at them, I'm really, you know, I find them very appealing, you know, and not necessarily in a sexual sense, but in an action oriented sense, that, that this is what I think a woman would look like in this circumstance. So I think that, you know, to me, it's very realistic to me. It's not a man. The common tripe is it's a man with a female appendages attached.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't do that, which I was very pleased to see. I really do believe that these are women, not men, doing that.
Thanks. Thank you, man. Thanks so much.
Now, of course, that leads me, John, back to you as far as like writing goes. I always have to ask, you know, writing female characters, when you approach this, particularly the female in the character, and she plays an obvious big role in this, how did you approach her? I mean, did you draw on your experiences with other women? How did you do that?
Well, yeah, it doesn't hurt that my wife is the editor of the book, so she helps keep me honest. But you know, ultimately, and you know, in the human experience, you know, it's understanding the characters. So I enjoy world building. I enjoy making characters. You know, back from, you know, playing, you know, role-playing games to you name it. But then also in finding the voice for characters, you have to understand also not just their strengths, but their weaknesses. And understanding that, you know, men have proclivities for different weaknesses than women do. And the same thing for strengths. And being okay to be honest about that. I know society doesn't always espouse that, but there are fundamental differences, you know, between men and women. And when we're okay to say that's okay, you know, and, you know, realizing that, you know, she's going to do things in a different fashion than her brother's going to do them for a number of different reasons. Mm-hmm. And part of that rationale is around who she is as a woman. And that's, I think, what helped. And it's fun because, you know, you kind of put a whole writing structure together for the story, and you build out the world and you build out the characters. But then as the characters form and grow and get more and more developed, they're the ones that really start, especially with the dialogue, really start writing the story. And they really start, you know, pointing you in the direction of where you're going to go. And then you're, you know, because writing is just constant rewriting. And you're like, man, you grow to a place and you realize, okay, she wouldn't do this. Okay. So I had something planned out, but she wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's a fun discovery. And I think as long as you're okay with the fact that, and this is true of this book, over the years that we've written this, until it was in print, the books were always in process.
Mm-hmm. See, to me, and I often say this on this podcast, is that women are unexplored, particularly in lead roles, as far as particularly comic books, and I think not only comic books, but in other areas, is that we've seen men for decades and decades, and men are scoundrels, and men are evil, and men are good guys, and men are scientists, and they can be all kinds of things. But women tend to be Lois Lane a lot of the times. And I get so frustrated with that because, you know, the women that I know in life aren't Lois Lane. And so to me, you know, what you're doing, I think, is helping to expand that thing and helping us to understand that women aren't only Lois Lane, and that her character does things that I found really fun, and I found her to be real on those ways. And so I thought, this is one of those characters that I hope people get to read, if for no other reason than to explore how she handles things as a woman. And she's not necessarily one kind of woman. You know, people always used to criticize Captain Janeway on Voyager because she wasn't maternal enough. You know, she needed to be, you know, and I always thought, well, but she gets to be a different person. Not every woman is maternal
right
to that extent. And so, like with your character, I just thought that the way you did this, she's all woman, but she still does things that are unique to her. And I just enjoyed that. I thought that was so great.
No, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, as we continue to develop the character, and, you know, and honestly, we really had the benefit of time. Because this story was so took so much time in germinating, we just, you know, we live with the characters for so long that, you know, we're really understanding, you know, where they're coming from and why they're doing things, and sometimes it's for obvious reasons, and other times it's for reasons just out of hurt and out of brokenness, and sometimes they don't even understand that those things are the things driving them, and that's part of the challenge with both Eric and Jen. Is part of what's driving them. They don't even have a full grasp on it. They want their dead father's approval in some ways.
Hmm. Yeah, well, and of course, Rod, this goes back to your, like I said, we're talking about the way you draw the female figure. Mm-hmm. I think the combination of you and John putting together a believable woman like that, I think was a real accomplishment. And I'm going to say the same thing to you, is that your artwork also, I thought, enhanced that character and made it realistic to me. So I wanted to tell you that too.
Oh, thanks, man. And I heard what you said to John, and I agree. Joe is bringing a new, fresh way to see comics, women in comics. Jen is a really strong character, and the enemies also have a lot of women. And it's so, so good to have opportunity to be part of this project. And much more will come on the next campaigns that we are planning. A lot of surprise on those characters.
I'm so looking forward to that. Now, the thing we need to make sure is that people know how to get a hold of Black Tiger Legacy of Fury, mm-hmm. and keep up with you guys. So, John, why don't you tell us how we can get a hold of Black Tiger Legacy of Fury?
So, Black Tiger Legacy of Fury is currently available on Indiegogo. So if you go to Indiegogo and if you just type in Black Tiger, you're going to probably see a couple of different options, both from Rod and I from Beyond Time. One is a live action film that we actually put together back in 2014, and it won the Spirit of Comic-Con award. And that's long closed, but you'll find this, this particular, campaign. It's currently in demand. So we have printed all of the soft covers and we're in the process of printing the hard covers. So, you know, we're kind of on the latter part of the campaign. We're going to fulfill until we don't have any more books to fulfill. And I think we probably in total, I think we may have 20 something soft cover books remaining and maybe another 15 hardcover.
Mm, great, great. And if people want to get them, where do they go?
Indiegogo.
And what about a website?
Type in Black Tiger. And you can go to our website, of course. Thank you. Appreciate that. BeyondTimeComics.com. If you go to BeyondTimeComics.com, you can access everything. You can access the Indiegogo page. You can also access our comic book web reader And you can look at the different books that we have on display there. We have Black Tiger. We have another property, which is currently in pre-launch mode on Indiegogo, called Magna, The Last Pantheon, in the same world. And we have a couple other properties that we have yet to release on paper, but you can read digitally. One is called The Posse, Fugitives, and the other one is called The Orphans, Family. And this is these are all these books are in the same universe.
Cool. Now, one of the things I wanted to point out about the Indiegogo, even though it's still going on in demand, initially, the way that I read it, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, you were looking for $500.
Well, what happened, we did a Kickstarter campaign previously.
Okay.
So with the Kickstarter, we funded the additional pages that Rod was adding to the book, because we had already produced the six issues that make up this graphic novel. And so, like I said, Rod and I, we've been doing this for a long time. The first four issues back in, in the 2004-05 timeframe, we solicited them through Diamond, and we distributed them to comic book shops. And that was a great learning process. Rod's art, the thing you'll see in this book is you'll see how Rod's art has developed and expanded and grown. One of the things, the pencils and the inks were great. One of the things, mistakes I made as a first time self-publisher, the colors and the letters, they weren't great. And that did not bode well for the book. So with this reprinting, the whole book has been recolored and relettered, and very much so to my utter satisfaction. Oh, and and we added, with the Kickstarter campaign, we added another 20 pages to fully flesh out the story. And then the Indiegogo, an opportunity just to hopefully get some more folks' eyeballs on the book.
Well, as I'm talking to you right now, there you have taken in there $4,000, just over $4,000, which is a great accomplishment, I think, for comics. Any comic, I think, out online, if you can get that much and develop that kind of an audience, I think that's a real accomplishment for you guys. So I have to congratulate you on that. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Thank you. We appreciate
thanks, Will,
that.
Thanks.
Now, as far as keeping up with you guys, let me go back to Rod here. Why, you mentioned that you have this there's video stuff that we can follow. What about if we wanted to follow you on like social media and stuff? How do we do that?
Well, you can find me on Instagram. Just look there for rod.looper. On Twitter, rod_looper. And on YouTube, I have a channel that is named 2D Art. It's easy. There you can find many of my work videos, process with Black Tiger pages, other comic books that I work, concept art, illustration, everything you can find there.
Cool. Very cool. Now, how about you, John?
So you can find me on Instagram and on Twitter at Beyond Time Inc., Beyond Time Inc. And you can find us on Facebook at beyondtimecomics.com. And also on YouTube, you can find me at Beyond Time Inc., Beyond Time Inc. I'm really enjoying the comic book community, so please don't hesitate to ping me, to reach out to me. It's been a very fun journey, and I'm just enjoying the community.
Real quickly before I let you go, John, are there projects you're working on right now besides this?
So the other project that we have in pre-launch mode on Indiegogo is called Magna, M-A-G-N-A, Magna, The Last Pantheon. So if you go to Indiegogo and you type in Magna or Magna, The Last Pantheon, you'll see the project, and it gives you the opportunity to get on the sign up list. And if you get on the sign up list prior to the launch, there we're going to provide some extra incentive goodies for folks, including giving folks that back at any level, a free digital copy of the book and some other goodies that we're going to also reveal before we launch.
Okay. And Rod, how about you? Are there projects you're working on we should know about?
Well, I'm working on the next few new pages for the next Black Tiger comic book. I'm doing some small stories, like short story of horror, sci-fi, and for lots of entertainment. And I'm working, still working on the graphic novel Detective Dead. I have a few pages to finish also. So I'm pretty busy month.
Well, I think you guys are doing wonderful stuff, and I wish you much more success as time goes forward. I hope we get to hear Black Tiger. I'd like to see more Black Tiger. I'd like to see an animated series or a live action show.
For sure.
You and me both, my friend. We would all love to see that.
So all I can say is keep it up and keep going. I think the future is bright for Black Tiger. So all I can say is keep doing what you're doing. I think the good things are coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. We appreciate you.
Appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.